Well, hello and welcome to another Capitol Record brought to you by National Review. This is David Bahnsen. I am very excited to be welcoming back to Capitol Record a second time a guest. That is my friend Louis Gov of GovCal Research. He joined us about a year ago now, I think maybe a little less, in what was really one of our most popular episodes of 2021. We did a deep dive into China, macroeconomics, talked kind of a number of aspects across global macro. Louis is one of my very favorite economic writers. I read something that he is writing nearly every day and have benefited greatly from the institutional research of not only his own writing, but that of his firm. His father, Charles Gov, also being a wonderful contributor to macroeconomic thought. And so here at Capitol Record, these are the types of people we want to have. And there are some specific reasons I have brought Louis back on today. So Louis, with that said, welcome back to Capitol Record.
Thanks. Thanks so much. I don't know if it was a year ago, but it was definitely at least 10 pounds ago for you. You're looking good.
Yeah, and 10 pounds is not a reference to sterling.
No.
Yes, although maybe with some of the Chinese equities, it's a reference to that too.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
So in the last, I guess, maybe 10 months or so, I think when we were last connecting, it was in the midst of some of the elevated sell-offs in the Chinese technology sector. So I think that was last summer. But of course, you know, the way these things seem to go, I don't know about you, I've done this long enough now that whenever someone says, can you believe how much is going on in this season? I always think like, no, because it just seems like always there's something going on. It's different things, but there's just always some sort of element. If you recall the Afghanistan withdrawal a year ago and everything we were talking about with that. And then now we're sitting here with Russia, Ukraine, and that actually seems to me to be leaving the news as well. What's your take in the overall macro environment in which we find ourselves? What do you think are the key stories, whether we're discussing them or not?
Look, there's so many paths to go down, right? And yes, to your point, there's always something exciting to talk about. That's the exciting job that we have. There's always something to worry about. The important thing, of course, is to take out the signal from the noise, right? Because there is so much noise out there. Now, I do tend to believe that there are an important number of signals today. For me, the Ukraine-Russia war is a game changer, not so much because of the war itself. You know, there's been other wars in the past 50 years, but because of, I would say, the Western world's reaction to the war. And basically what we've decided to do is weaponize our currencies and weaponize our financial systems against Russia in a way that they've never been weaponized before. So, you know, this will have long-term consequences. I think some of them we're already seeing. So, you know, that's one big change. You know, another big change, of course, is the energy crisis. You know, we are in the midst of an energy crisis. Simply put, I don't think Russia would have invaded Ukraine if we hadn't followed knuckleheaded energy policies for the past 5 years in Europe, in the U.S., everywhere, where we've basically refused to invest in carbon and made it impossible for people who wanted to invest in carbon to do so. And now we're sort of reaping what we've sown in the form of both higher geopolitical tensions, because when we prevent investments in carbon, we in essence harm bad actors like Vladimir Putin and give him more leverage than he otherwise would have, but also planted the seeds for a long-lasting inflation, which has completely dramatically upended our investment environment. So, you know, so first we have this Russia thing, then we have an energy crisis, and then on top of it all, we have China's zero COVID policies, which are devastating for growth in China, frankly, devastating for people who live there. You know, as someone who runs a business in Hong Kong and Beijing, this is it's a real challenge, and devastating for global supply chains. Let's not beat around the bush. You know, what we're basically looking at is a summer where Americans will have the privilege of paying $7.50 for gas to drive to empty Walmarts, and you know, politically, that will have consequences. So there is a lot going on. For me, the main takeaways are, you know, today's inflation is here to stay. Today's energy prices are here to stay. And we have to invest for a world where energy is scarce. You know, you look around the world today, there's one bull market left. That bull market is energy. And, you know, do we need to overthink this? Energy prices, energy stocks sort of go up week in, week out. They don't go up every day, but they go up almost every week now. They're still not overvalued. They've got positive momentum. They're still undervalued. Do we need to overthink this? This is clearly where the market is pushing us. Let's not fight it. Let's just do that.
Yeah. So there's a lot there to unpack. And when I think we're going to end up, if I go down this path, spending the whole podcast on this inflation as secular versus cyclical discussion. And actually it would be a great conversation. And there's few people I'd rather have it with than you. I don't think you and I are on the same side of that subject, but the problem is there's so many other things I want to talk about. And you brought something up that's very important. The Russia-Ukraine impact on inflation, the Chinese lockdowns and supply chain impact, and then, of course, the energy price story. Regardless of what one believes about the sustainability of consumer goods inflation or the how monetary this particular inflation is, nobody can dispute the element of inflation evidenced in energy, in supply chain disruptions and things like that. Do you believe that we're simply dealing with a piling on from extrinsic circumstances and supply chain, China lockdowns, Russia invasion, poor U.S. energy preparation, that those things are piling on what was already an inflationary milieu because of excessive monetary policy? Or do you think, as I do, that those things are the cause of the current inflation?
I think they're a pylon. I think it's more the first. I think, look, we followed crazy monetary and fiscal policies. And I think at this point, everybody realizes, you know, simply put, countries who followed the crazy monetary and fiscal policies are ending up with inflation rates of above 5%, and countries that didn't have inflation rates of below 5. You know, look at the difference between Switzerland and Germany.
Let's just at least caveat that there's sort of one kind of obvious exception in Japan.
Yeah.
Right?
But okay, true. Japan doesn't have a high inflation rate. And
has anybody had crazier monetary policy? Has anybody had crazier fiscal policy?
Well, look, you know, U.S. money, broad money supply in the U.S. was 26% for 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
The highest it ever got was 13% in the 1970s. So in terms of being unprecedented monetary expansion, the U.S. went further than Japan over the past couple of years. And so, yes, you end up with higher inflation. In terms of blowing out your budget deficits, you know, the U.S. went basically 2 years with budget deficits of over 10% of GDP, again, funded through printing of money. So, Joe Biden came in, the first thing he did in a roaring economy is he expanded the budget deficit further. And, you know, and then he tried to do it yet another time with another infrastructure spending bill.
Isn't that a beautiful thing about the American political system? That you can suffer your biggest political defeat of your career by your signature legislation that you spent all year preparing and bragging on. It can fail, not get passed, and then you can brag that it didn't happen.
Yep. It's amazing.
Truly amazing.
Truly amazing. But no, look, so not only have you had the crazy and monetary fiscal policies, you also had crazy energy policy. Look, no. Joe Biden, first thing he does is block Keystone Pipeline to now turn around and try to cut a deal with the Iranians and the Venezuelans, as if Canada was some kind of, you know, repulsive country that we can't do a deal with. So, you know, look, every policy, every country, you know, it's what Adam Smith said, there's a lot of ruin in every nation. You can follow a crazy fiscal policy. You can follow a crazy energy policy. You can follow a crazy monetary policy. But if you do it all at the same time, it starts adding up. And that's where you are in the U.S. And frankly, that's where you are in Europe.
The problem with though what you say about it doing it all and it adds up, because I agree with you completely, But it does make identifying causation at least a bit more controversial, a bit more disputable.
Look, you and I can debate all day what the causation is, et cetera. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, right? The end result is it's here. We've had crazy energy policy. We've had crazy money. We've had crazy fiscal. And by the way, Japan hasn't had a crazy energy policy. You'll note that in this whole Russia-Ukraine invasion, et cetera, while Europe has jumped on the bandwagon of let's block Russia, block energy imports, let's punish Russia, et cetera, Japan has been very quiet. And Japan is still importing a ton of natural gas from Russia. Now, if like me, you believe that economic activity is fundamentally energy transformed of one way or the other, and that the guy with the cheapest cost of energy typically wins, you know, Japan is right now making sure that they're not the one with the highest cost of energy. And that if Europe wants to commit economic suicide, good on them. But Japan isn't going to follow them down the primrose path. So, you know, yes, you know, Japan doesn't have the same inflation problem. China doesn't have the same inflation problem. India and Brazil don't have the same inflation problem. You know, the ones that have been following your typical emerging market policies of crazy monetary, crazy fiscal, crazy energy policies, you know, the kind of stuff you'd expect from Argentina in the past, it's the US and it's Europe. And that's where the inflation problem is. You know, again, you don't have double-digit inflation in China. You don't have double-digit inflation in Japan because they haven't followed the same knuckleheaded policies we have.
Yeah, I still think, and here I am doing what I said I wasn't going to do because we have to move to crypto and the US stock market and all kinds of other things. But the challenge I have is that oil demand globally is still a tiny bit less, right near the level it was in 2019. And prices are almost double. And there's a supply difference in both stockpile inventory and daily production that explains all of it. And it's a monumental policy failure, not only in the macro and in the whole, but particularly for those who want U.S. economic share, which I'm one of, and apparently the president of this country is not, who you know, was working the phones to ask Russia and ask Middle Eastern countries to pick up the slack. By the way, you get this energy stuff as well as anyone. Am I right that coal is going to end up being the massive winner out of this Russia-Ukraine?
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. Look, the reality is we have an energy shortage. And there's only two ways to solve it. Look, eight out of 10 OPEC top producers can't meet their quotas right now. You know, US, to your point, in 2019 was producing 13 million barrels per day. US is now producing 11.8 million barrels per day. And it's not because they don't want to produce, it's because they can't. Because producing in the shale patch is extremely capital intensive, and there is no more capital for producing oil, even at these prices. So there's two choices going forward. Option one, you go back to coal. China's already going down this path. India's going down this path. Brazil's going down this path. You say, to hell with COP26, to hell with climate change. You know, between being cold and being polluted, I'm going to pick being polluted. And again, most emerging market countries are going down this path. So that's option one. Or option two, you ration energy. And those are basically your two choices. And very clearly, Europe is sending all the signals that they're going to go down the latter path, you know. But let's not beat around the bush. Rationing energy, again, if an economic activity is energy transformed, rationing energy is akin to committing economic suicide. You're killing your industry, killing jobs, and more importantly, you're sending false signals into your economy, right? It's energy is such an important key component that if you falsify that price, you just mess up everything, just like, you know, when you mess up any price. But so, yes, you have emerging markets that are going down the path of coal, and then you have Europe that's going down the path of rationing. Guess which one's going to win? If economic activity is energy transformed, the guy with the cheapest cost of energy wins. And so, you know, yes, coal is going to be the winner. Yes, emerging markets are going to be the winner.
So the stock market on the year, it's interesting. You brought up since last year, Russia, Ukraine, this huge geopolitical event, the response to weaponized currency, a pretty significant story. I do need to ask you why the ruble has rallied so much since its initial crash. I think that's something on listeners' minds, that despite the weaponization, either it hasn't worked or there is some significant manipulation at play that is offsetting the other manipulation. But these are big stories. And then you talk about the inflation. Regardless of causation, the world is dealing with rising food and energy prices. And yet you didn't bring up some of the stock market distress. And it would seem to me that if I sat here and said, Lewis, the Dow is down 12% on the year. Well, you know, that's double digits. It's a correction. It's not nothing. But it does happen most years that there's some intra-year drawdown of 8 to 14%. Now, the S&P being close to 20, that's more significant. And obviously, the NASDAQ being from peak to trough at 30, as we're sitting here talking, that's definitely a bigger deal. But even beyond the, let's call it 10, 20, and 30 of the three respective market indices in the U.S., really, if we were to make an index, or I guess you could call Kathy's index, you know, if you were to make an index of just all the real trash out there, the real speculative web 3.0, tech this, tech new economy that, whatever.
Crypto this.
Yeah, I mean, it's down 50 if it's done okay. And in some cases, 80 or 90 if it's Peloton and Zoom and other things that were at one point, I think, valued more than Exxon during the COVID days. I wish I was kidding, but a friggin' exercise bike with an iPad was valued more than Exxon Mobil, for God's sake. And so,
which is why we're in an energy crisis today. There was no incentive for Exxon to deploy capital.
Well, that's right. There was no incentive, and obviously, you know, this was kind of by design with policymakers, and not even outside of politics, in the culture at large, the ESG culture kind of wanted this outcome. But my question is this a .com story where the Super Bowl commercials change, the pop culture references change, but there's not really a macroeconomic hit? And in fact, the Dow was up in the year 2000, and it wasn't really until 9/11 that started to feel like an actual bear market to everybody, even though the NASDAQ was down, what, 70%? Is that what this is, or is there something bigger going on, and it's rising rates and it's Fed and it's tightening and Jay Powell is really a secret Paul Volcker? You know, I like you, was a part of John Malden's conference, and I heard speaker after speaker talk about Powell as the new Volcker, and they're going to tighten more than people think. I'm just not sure I buy it.
I don't buy it at all. I think, to me, the line I've used is, you know, if you have kids, or your listeners who have kids might relate to this, or at least those who are bad parents like I am, will relate to this, where you're driving with your kids and, you know, they're making a ruckus in the back seat, and you say, kids, you know, shut up, or I'm going to pull over the car and abandon you on the side of the road. You have no intention of pulling over the car, and you have no intention of abandoning your kids. For me, this is the Fed. You know, they keep telling us, you know, you guys watch out, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, etc. But deep down, they're still growing their balance sheet as we speak. And the reality is their ability to tighten is severely constrained by the fact that there are no more buyers of, and especially no more foreign buyers of U.S. treasuries. And if ever there were foreign buyers of U.S. treasuries, those have just disappeared because, you know, by nationalizing Russian assets in the way we have, by saying, look, these bonds that you've accumulated over the past 20 years and that you thought were yours, they're not yours. We're taking them away because we think you're a jerk. And you are a jerk, but, you know, we're taking them away without any debate in Congress. We're taking them away without any debate in front of courts, without any prosecutor, without any due process, just on an executive order from one day to the next, we're taking these away. You know, if you're a Saudi prince, you have to think, well, hold on. If tomorrow 20 imbeciles hijack a plane and drive it into a building, does that mean that my holdings will get confiscated? If you're a rich Chinese guy, you think, well, hold on. If tomorrow Xi Jinping decides to invade Taiwan, something I have no visibility on and no influence over, does that mean that my treasuries will get confiscated? Then these treasuries are not what I thought they were. You know, I've owned these as a safety asset for when, excuse my French, but when shit hits the fan. And now I find out that, you know, when the brown stuff meets the ventilating device, I lose access to those. And I don't need those. You know, these are worthless to me. They give me -5% real. You know, the only reason I'd have them is for their safety attributes. And that's just shifted because they're now safe depending on who you are, which is something new in our legal systems. You know, our the biggest comparative advantage of the Western world by a long shot is the rule of law, is property rights, is the fact that you can be black, brown, white, you can be Hindu, Jewish, Muslim, Christian. You go in front of a court of law and justice is blind and you're going to have the same fair shake as the next guy. And now we've just added an asterisk to this and said, except if you're Russian. If you're Russian, we can take all your stuff. And we can take all your stuff without any recourse, without any courts, without any due process. We can just confiscate it. And so
I fully agree with you, but I just got to pretend to make this interesting. Well, because I think not every listener will agree. And I want them represented as a devil's advocate. Is a difference that these Russian oligarchs you're talking about are not really distinguishable from the Russian state. In other words, we have seized assets of nefarious state actors, terrorists, dictators. That kind of thing has certainly happened. It's a normal wartime convention.
But I think, sure, but then you prove it in a court of law. That's the whole point, right? That's the whole point of having a legal due process.
Of being
a Western state. That's the whole point is, if these guys are this, we prove it in court and we take it. We don't just decide. Because that's how justice is in China. That's how justice is in Russia. It's like, oh, you know what? We think, we can't prove it, but we think you're a bad actor, so we're going to take your stuff. Right? That's what happens over there, not over here. But so again, like what you and I think of this really doesn't matter at the end of the day. What matters is if you're a rich Chinese guy or you're a rich Saudi prince and you see this and you see how easy it's been in this new cancel culture of ours, how easy it is to cancel Russian oligarchs, you have to feel I could be next, right? It's like, it's all of a sudden, again, these assets that you thought were safe, that house in Vancouver, or that condo in Miami, or that treasury portfolio that you thought was safe, it turns out it isn't. Or it's not as safe as you thought it was. It doesn't have the same attributes. And so what's very interesting to me, to answer your, it's a long-winded answer to your question on U.S. equities. Because yes, U.S. equities have gone down, and you know some have gone down a lot, and 80 and 90%. And yes, they were crappy business models. But you know they'd gone up 500%, so now they're down 80%. So you know it's a round trip. And okay, fine. What's much more important is that while this is happening, you're losing your shirt on U.S. treasuries at the same time. That's the new development. That's what's different from 2000. Right? Here's the way I'd put it. Look at it this way. You're a private wealth guy, right? And you have two instruments. You have TLT and SPX. And you have three types of clients. You have an old client, a middle-aged client, and a young client. Your old client, you say, you know what? I'm going to put you 80% TLT, 20% SPX. Your middle-aged, you're going to do 50-50. And your young guy, you're going to do 80% SPX, 20% TLT. And now we're in a bear market. And all of a sudden, you have to tell your conservative older client, who's 80% in TLT, that he's losing more money than your aggressive young client, who's 80% SPX, 20% TLT. And you're both losing on both sides, by the way. But all of a sudden, you're losing more on bonds than you are on your long, very long-dated bonds than you are on equities. Yeah. This is what's completely new.
You know what's interesting is that there's only been four times in the last 100 years that stocks—
We've lost money on both. Yeah,
and yet one of them was 2 years ago. Was 2018.
Yeah, but so, you barely lost on bonds. You lost like a tiny, barely.
But basis points.
Yeah.
And even stocks doesn't barely count. 5% is the only down year in a decade.
So it wasn't a lot of pain. This is pain.
I agree. Although just as much as the year to date performance in the bond market, particularly long duration, is pain. And if anyone was sitting out there with a huge amount, let's call it 80% of their portfolio in 30-year treasuries or 10 to 20-year treasuries, obviously in real life, that's not very likely. But even a diversified blend of high-grade corporates of a medium duration, treasuries, munis, et cetera, it's still down high single digits. Yep. That's substantial. That's net of offsetting coupon.
Because you have to remember as well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that guy who's in 80% in, you know, bonds, munis, etc., he's old typically, right? He's not 25 years old, where right. if he takes a 10% hit on his, as a 25-year-old, you take a 10% hit on your portfolio, it's whatever. You'll make it up. You got 40 years, 50 years ahead of you. The 75-year-old guy who takes a 10% hit, that's a whole different ballgame.
But at the same time, Treasury ETFs, which admittedly are a tiny, tiny representation of the Treasury bond market, Treasury ETFs have had their highest inflows in May of 2022 than any month ever in history, and including March of 2020. And I would point out the 10-year was at 325 2 weeks ago, and it's at 275 today. I don't know. If it turns out 325, which was the high point of 2018 as well, when Powell tightened last time, if the 10-year is going to peak at 325, bond investors could do worse than that.
They could do a whole lot worse than that. But of course, if they're going to peak there, then there's better things to do, right? You got to load up on U.S. home builders, for example, that have gotten absolutely smoked and that today offer tremendous value. But by the way, if they're going to peak at 325, then you should load up on all sorts of commodities. And you should, including energy, of course, which, you know, energy is now the new bonds because, you know, in this world of ours, this new inflationary world of ours, the cycle won't roll over because interest rates go up too much. The cycle will roll over because energy prices go up too much. It's energy that will break the back of the economic cycle. Now, to your point, you know, demand isn't back to where it was in 2019 for a very simple reason. China's been on lockdown. You know, when China reopens, you know, your energy price will go one way, and that's higher. And then indeed we'll see at that point, you know, what bond yields do. Do bond yields brush off a rising energy price, or do they go along for the ride and move higher?
And you're, is that a rhetorical question or do you have a call there? See, I would
think it's not a rhetorical question. They move higher.
Right. And that's your outlook. Yep. Would you admit that's been the most difficult call on bond yields that you've seen in your adult life? It's been nothing but called higher. It's done nothing but go lower, more or less.
Yeah. But look, I think the call's pretty easy now. We have high inflation. We have a Fed that's massively behind the curve. Bonds destroy capital year in, year out. Policymakers actually want capital to be destroyed in bonds. You know, they want to maintain negative real rates. They want the bondholders to be the ultimate bag holders. You have, like I said, you're an unfolding energy crisis. And on top of this, you've just changed the safety attributes of these very assets. You've taken away the very reason to own these things, which is safety, and you've taken that away. So for me, actually, this is as easy a call as I've seen in my career. It's like, why on earth would anybody want to own U.S. Treasuries in this environment? Do you really think the only way you'd want to own them is if you think, like all the speakers at the Malden conference, that Jay Powell is the new Paul Volcker, that he's going to keep raising interest rates until he crushes the economy. I think he's the dad in the car who tells the kids to shut up because he's going to pull over the car and never does.
Yeah, but aren't you saying the opposite then? It seems to me if he's going to capitulate, then bond yields find a peak. And what they're saying is he's going to keep going.
Because you and I look at it from different angles. You look at it as a U.S. investor who's right. invested in U.S. dollar. Here's the reality is Jay Powell is going to have a choice, which is the choice, by the way, the BOJ just had to make. Do I save the bond market or do I save the currency? And as a foreign investor, you know, I'm a French guy living in Canada who's made most of my businesses in China. You know, I look at the U.S. and I think, I don't know if I'm going to lose on the bonds or I'm going to lose on the currency, but I'm going to lose on one or the other. You know, I know that today the view in the market is the U.S. dollar is going higher. The U.S. dollar is the wrecking ball, etc. I don't believe the U.S. dollar is the wrecking ball. I believe energy is the wrecking ball. And the energy price will end up wrecking either the US dollar or the bond market. I think it ends up wrecking the bond market, actually, and potentially both. It can easily wreck both.
Yeah.
Given the set of policies you have in the US, it could easily wreck both. But as a foreign investor, why would I want to buy US treasuries? You know, what's in it for me?
Yeah, so it's a very good distinction you make from the vantage point of a global investor, from the vantage point of sovereign wealth funds versus a U.S. investor denominated in dollar who is looking for a safe haven part of their portfolio. Look, if I did have an interest rate call that yields had peaked and were going lower, I still have a hard time with anything at the 10-year. But particularly with a yield curve that's dead flat from 2 to 10, I don't know. It's hard to be bearish on a 2-year.
Yeah, I agree with that.
At 265.
No. I agree with that. I think we see a big yield curve steepening. I'd be long the 2 years. You know, the Fed, the market is anticipating way too much out of the Fed. So I think that the 2-year rallies and the US dollar goes down as these expectations basically meet the reality sometime at the end of the year. Because, you know, what happens as we come close to the end of the year? The first thing that happens as we come, I think, into September, October, is that you start getting into the hedge fund redemption cycle. You know, the reality is a lot of hedge funds, you know, you ripped a little bit on Cathie Wood, but Cathie did what she said she would do, right?
Yep.
She never pretended to do anything than what she's done.
That's right.
It's, you know, what you see is what you bought.
But and by the way, I didn't rip Cathie. For the very reason you said, I ripped some of the stocks that are in that portfolio.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But that's exactly what it was. In fact, I'm quite defensive of Cathie. You're going to see, I'll give National Review listeners right now a little sneak peek. I'm not supposed to say anything. I'm saying it to you. the Wall Street Journal has a big story coming out either this coming Friday, the day after people are listening to this podcast, or early next week, with a massive hit on some of these hedge funds, and they thoroughly interview me, where basically what I say is these tigers and some of these others that have just destroyed capital are ARK with 2 and 20.
Well, so, and that, I was about to come to this. So, like, Cathie, you know, you got what she was very clear on what she was doing. You know, most people bought hedge funds on the premise that you're hedged. You know, it's in the name. That's written on the tin. And when you go down more than the NASDAQ, then you're not a hedge fund. You know, there's no hedge in there. You're a levered long fund or you're whatever else. But and so this is where you'll see a lot of redemptions in the coming cycle. Now, you know, a lot of these guys had a tough first quarter. Most of them have 6 weeks notices, right? So the first quarter was a disaster. And most people thought, okay, let's wait for the rebound. I don't want to redeem them now, etc. Then April and May are disasters, but by mid-May you've lost the window to redeem, right? So the next window to redeem is mid-October, it's mid-August. Mid-August is the next window to redeem, but then you have to sell in September and October to make the month-end redemptions, and so that's when I think that things will get tricky, because you get a lot of these funds will be in situations having done a lot of illiquids, having been a lot of names that are around 90% and no liquidity, etc. You end up selling what you can, not what you should.
What will save those funds is 3-year lockups and 2-year lockups, because everybody who thought they were getting a good deal with quarterly redemption is about to find out. Sometimes you don't want to be liquid.
Yeah. No. So what's going to end up happening is people will sell what they can, not what they should. And what they can sell is Microsoft and it's Apple, sure, et cetera. And I think that's the, you know, the phase of the bear market we're now entering into. So you're now entering September, October. You got a market that's lower. You're in a full on bear market. And let's face it, you know, you've got as many gray hairs as I have. You know, how bear markets, we've seen them. They end either when the Fed stops, starts easing. We're nowhere near that. When the energy prices collapse, which frees up liquidity for the market. We're nowhere near that. Or when valuations get so cheap that you just have to buy because it's that cheap. And we're not there either. So we're now in a bear market. We're in a bear market on bonds and on equities for the first time. So you're getting hit on both sides of your portfolio. And you have none of the usual cavalry coming to the rescue. Valuations aren't coming to the rescue for a long time. Fed isn't coming to the rescue until 2023 at the earliest, and energy prices are moving against you. So, you know, you're now in a situation where you're in a bear market, you sell what you can, not what you should. This isn't the kind of environment as you come into year end where the Fed is going to be massively hawkish, which is why I think, you know, the Fed throws in the towel at the end, before the end of this year, and people start pricing in easing in 2023. And as you get the pricing of easing in 2023, the US dollar really, really takes it in the shorts.
So the dollar's comeuppance is 2023. The actions that are creating this eventual euthanization of the dollar are the things you've been talking about for over a year. It's just that seeing it reflected in Forex markets is still a ways off for all the reasons you've explained. And yet, when we look at the vulnerability in the currency, in the bond market, in equities, the one thing that has proven to be an incredibly safe haven through all of this is Bitcoin. Am I right?
Right. Yeah, that's right. So, wish I'd had all my money in crypto.
you wrote a piece that intrigued me about some of the things, you know, in the past. You look at significant destruction of wealth that has taken place out of bigger than run-of-the-mill cyclical recessions and the incredible allure to regulators and to politicians to jump in and save the day. You think about the Spitzer phenomena that came about after .com. Obviously, we're familiar with Dodd-Frank and the Fed and everything, the complete reshaping of the U.S. financial system after GFC. There's a lot of examples. We're still kind of sorting through this increased scrutiny and regulation with China post-Trump. These things aren't uncommon throughout history, but you brought up whether or not there may be a temptation for the policymakers to jump in if crypto losses, I think at one point they were only about $500 billion. That seems like a lot of money. Now it appears
$1.6 trillion.
If you look at NFT, Ethereum, and exchanges, and Bitcoin Direct, that you're above $1.5 trillion. And I think that's global, not domestic.
Yeah. Now that the global crypto space in the past 3 months has destroyed $1.6 trillion of value.
So, let's assume that's proper money. That's grown up money. Yeah. Let's assume that a lot of it is US based. My thesis is that
that's one Biden stimulus plan right there gone poof.
Yeah, completely gone. The entire stimulus bill. The difference is the stimulus bill has to be paid back.
Yes.
But in all seriousness, I think it's very sad when people with not much money buy pets.com in 1999.
Yes, of course.
And I think it's sad with people that were lost their job and were on lockdown and got a government check, and their whole world's turned upside down, and grandma's sick from COVID, and they're on an app called Robinhood effing around with stocks and so forth that their friends have told them about, and they lose 70% of their capital. I think it is sad, but nobody believes it's systemic.
Yeah, no.
Is this crypto mess systemic?
Well, so on the plus side, to your point, and look, nobody likes losing $1.6 trillion. And it's hard to think it doesn't have repercussions when it's that big an impact. On the positive side, most of the people who lost a lot of money in the crypto space tend to be quite young. It's been an odd bull market, this crypto bull market. It was disproportionately the, you know, 15 to 25 year olds who were massively involved in it. So these guys have their whole lives to make this up. And, you know, they can put it down as lesson learned. They can, you know, it's one thing when a 25 year old loses money, it's another when a 70 year old loses money. So that's I would say is the positive angle to it. The negative angle is, yes, you have $1.6 trillion, and it's hard to think this isn't going to impact consumption. And I think you're already starting to see, you know, weaker consumption data. It's hard to think that it's not going to impact people's willingness to take risk. And frankly, you know, it's going to impact venture capital activity. It's, you know, and in that respect, I think, you know, today's blow up is, you could say, well, you know, Bitcoin, it's had whatever it is, five times it's gone down 80% and it's always come back. But it was always on much smaller numbers, right?
Oh, yeah.
This is, you know, it's one thing to go down when you've got a market cap of 20 billion and you go down 80% and you come back, you know, but now it's just much, much, much bigger numbers. So to get this thing back up, you're going to need massive amounts of money to come from somewhere. And where's that somewhere going to come? We know it's not going to come from the Fed, at least not immediately. And so, you know, you look at this space and yes, this looks like a deeply, deeply damaged space. And so from there, you think, okay, crypto is deeply damaged. Most likely regulators are going to come sniffing around for blood. And by the way, your point on Spitzer, I just want to make a very side quick point. I personally hold Spitzer responsible for the 2008 crisis because if you remember, post 2000, he went after Hank Greenberg and in essence pushed Hank Greenberg out of AIG. Now, AIG was, you know, it's a huge business in Hong Kong. AIG was held like Hank Greenberg knew how many envelopes were in the cupboard. I mean, it was held like he held every piece of that organization. He was pushed out, and then that organization started writing CDSs on every piece of crap paper out there, and then it ended up fueling the mortgage bubble all by itself, and then imploding it, and then the implosion on the other side. And the real problem in 2008 wasn't as much Lehman going bust as AIG going bust. Hank Greenberg had been left at the helm of it, this would have never happened. All right, so side point, all this to say that regulators...
I would just like to say for my Capital Record listeners that Louis knows damn well he's oversimplifying.
Of course.
And he's rightly identifying a just absolutely tragic and unforgivable error by Spitzer, what actually was catalytic and so forth in the whole thing, you know, is a bit harder to unpack, but I take your point.
Well, the broader point is once regulators come barging in with big shoes to close barn doors after horses have fled, you end up changing an ecosystem with repercussions that are hard to envisage. And the reality is we're most likely going to see that in crypto today. I don't see how the US regulators don't come sniffing around after what's just happened. And if you come sniffing around now, start closing barn doors, this is yet another hurdle for all the aggressive growth stocks, because that's not, you know, beat around the bush. There's a one-for-one correlation at this point between the crypto market and the aggressive growth space. So, you know, if you think the crypto space is damaged, and I think it's damaged, then it's pretty hard to envisage a big rally in your NASDAQ stuff as well. So you're left with a big, basically the whole growth part of the market, what's been driving you forward, just structurally damaged.
But that's an important point, is people could hear the headline of what you said, they're coming to help you because you lost crypto, and misunderstand. What you're saying is what they would be doing represents further pain.
Yeah, absolutely.
More regulation, more barrier, more involvement. Particularly, it's one thing if they say, we're going to raise margin requirements so people don't get hurt in pets.com. You know, there's a sort of financial safety involvement that we can either think is helpful and prudent or not. But it's somewhat separate from the fundamental thesis of whatever Pets.com's business model was. Maybe that was the problem, is it didn't have a business model. But crypto's entire business model, if you will, is disintermediation from the federal government.
And the lack of regulation. So
exactly.
you take that away, it's like, oh, you know, what is this? So you're left, and that brings me to I think an important point. We are in the midst of a bear market, and bear markets have a purpose. And the bear market's purpose usually is to transfer the leadership from one group of stocks or one part of the market to another. We were in an aggressive growth bull market led by the NASDAQs and the ARKs, et cetera, of this world. And we're now entering into another bull market. And it's a bull market on energy, and it's a bull market on commodities, and it's a bull market on, I think, a lot of emerging markets. And that's the one you have to basically get behind. And, you know, the bull markets, you start to see those trends evolve. in the midst of a bear market. And the tendency so many investors have is to look at, oh, Peloton's down 90%, therefore it must be cheap, therefore I should buy it because it's down 90%. The reality is a stock that's down 90% can go down another 90%, and from there it can go down another 90%, especially if it doesn't have a business model, especially if it doesn't generate positive cash flows. And a lot of these growth stocks don't generate positive cash flows. They're in essence dependent on constant injections of capital from the market, and the market itself is dependent on constant injections of capital from central banks. Now, do you think we live in a world where central banks are going to come in and bail out the Pelotons of this world and bail out the cryptos? And bail out the answer is no. In fact, quite the contrary. We're now entered, and I think that's what I used in my piece, we've entered the lawyer phase of the market, where instead of the government coming in to help you, they're coming in to see what you've done wrong. They're coming in to say, show me your books. Let's look at the statements you've made over the years. Let's look at your social media feeds. Oh, I'm going to prosecute you for this. I'm going to prosecute you for that. We've entered, in a lot of that space, the lawyer phase of the bear market. And there, you don't want to be an owner for that piece of the market. Like, that's the, you know, you don't, you know, as much as I love lawyers as much as the next guys, but, you know, you see lawyers, you want to run away. You want to run away. And so you go to the part of the market where instead of getting more lawyers, they're going to get less. And guess what part that is? I hate to beat a dead horse here, but it's energy. For the past 10 years, we've told energy, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do that. And now for the next 10 years, it's please do this. Just do whatever you want. Just get it done. That's going to be the message for the next 10 years.
So the takeaways, it sounds like to me, are you and I were not ones prone to shiny objects like crypto and Web 3.0 and Peloton before we began some of these conversations. And it doesn't sound like either one of us want to go in now. I continue to like dividend growing, value-oriented equities of good free cash flow generation and reasonably low leverage that are less prone to needing multiple expansion to make money. I don't know if you like that asset class or not.
Sure. For sure. In an environment of tight liquidity, that's a safe asset class to own, right? The first thing is you can't own any business that needs capital. I mean, that's the first thing. So anything that's in the negative cash flow, you just throw it in the bin. You don't look at it until the Fed at least starts putting capital back into the system. And then there, to your point, there's two parts. You either look for things that have very stable and predictable cash flows. And, you know, in today's world, these aren't so easy to find. But when you find them, they can be the bedrock of your portfolio and they're fine and they stick there, et cetera. Or for things that have accelerating cash flows. And in today's world, the only place with accelerating cash flows is energy.
And so energy as a sector, not just U.S., but global?
that's a very tough one. I like Canadian energy the best because I tend to think, and it's on my home market bias. It really is, you know, the reality is the U.S., you know, has basically blocked Canadian energy for political reasons, but that won't last. To your point, either it'll change after the midterms or it'll change after the next presidential election because economically it makes no sense for the U.S. to tell Canada, we won't take your oil, so ship it all to China, which is in essence the message. In a world in which the U.S. has to step in to help Europe, and ship more and more of its natural gas to Europe and see the price of natural gas go through the roof in the U.S., the U.S. will turn to Canada and say, all right, give us your natural gas. That's a very low-hanging fruit with a lot of optionality when the U.S. stops being politically stupid. And, you know, I love to quote Churchill that the U.S. always does the right thing after having tried every other option first. When it comes to Canadian energy, the U.S. will end up doing the right thing because it is so bloody obvious. It'd be so, like, it's so painfully obvious. So that's, you know, that's one. I like Petrobras a lot, I have to say. I know we're not supposed to probably call names, but, you know, just, you know, we need extra oil from somewhere, and offshore Brazil is the obvious place where you can get a lot out of there. So I feel very happy owning energy in the Americas, and just the up and down through the Americas. Europe, you know, if you, the big challenge in Europe, like I mentioned, is I think we're heading towards rationing in Europe. And we're probably going to end up with price controls. And so, you know, the likes of Total and the likes of Shell and the likes of BP will probably be told you're only allowed to sell at that price. Or if you sell at a higher price, we'll put in special taxes on your profits. So I think the danger there is just greater. And so I'd much rather own my energy in the Americas.
Okay, well, look, we can do another hour of this, no problem. The problem is we're out of time, and I would love to have you back on and revisit. We'll see what wars have started, what countries we're going to, you know, confiscate the money from, which countries have gone into lockdown, where COVID, you know, 20 is, and whatever else is next. One thing I do know, whether you're back on in a month or a year, I certainly hope it's not another year, but I know that there will be more moving parts. I have a feeling the interesting conversation will be, and let's say it's another few months when we regroup, if where we are in that 10-year bond yield. I think if the 10-year wants to putt around here, around high twos, low threes, I think it's just the bond market saying, we don't believe that Powell is going to do anything. We don't believe that this inflation is going to last past some of these moments. And we think that there's going to be more can kicking up ahead and maybe setting the stage for some debt deflation problems that aren't any more pleasant than the inflationary problems we're dealing with now.
By the way, I don't disagree with this. I'd add one thing is if we're there, putzing around there, I think gold is above 2000 and the US dollar has rolled over and is no longer, the market is no longer running around talking about how the US dollar is the big wrecking ball that's going to destroy everything.
So the dollar and the bond market, the correlation's broken up. Yeah. Good stuff. We have to keep doing our part to defend a sensible approach to capital markets. I love talking with Lewis about all these things. Appreciate the great work of GovCal Research in my daily inbox. Thanks so much for joining us again, Louis.
Pleasure. See you soon.
And thank you all for listening to another episode of Capital Record. Obviously, there's plenty of food for thought here today. For those of you that are deeply hurting in your crypto losses, please do not hold anything that either Lewis or I said against us. And in the meantime, we'll continue doing our part to defend the cause of a free and virtuous society every week. The cause of free enterprise and the cause of capital markets is an important one. We're going to do our part here at National Review's Capital Record. Thanks so much for listening.